Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm your host, Ray Bohax, the Hot Rod Farmer from the Farm Machinery Digest website. The Dryland Farmer from Catswamp Road, New Jersey. Yes, there are farms in New Jersey. So welcome to today's show. And I want to just thank you up front for listening. And I want to also ask you, if you have not at this particular point, please go to my website. It's farmmachinerydigest.com, and specifically look under the learning tab, and you will see there's about 53 different eclectic articles about all aspects of farm machinery, engines, and what have you, that I believe sincerely will bring value to your operation. And education is never lost. You may read something there today or listen on the podcast today and not be able to apply it, but 6 months or a year from now or even tomorrow, you may be able to apply it. So just remember that success on the farm or the ranch is a three-legged stool. It's agronomy or animal husbandry, it's marketing, and it is machinery. That you need to have your machinery run efficiently and minimize downtime and repairs, because they cost you money, and that money comes from your bottom line, from your profits. And the impetus for me to do this show and the website is to help prosper the American farmer in the only way that I know how. I can't help you grow crops, I can't help you do anything else, but I can help you with your machinery. So, you know, today's show, what I'm going to be talking about is, well, let me back up for a second, because I want to try to give you some continuity here. When I choose topics for each show, and I think this is show 57, so that means there's actually one more, 58, because it's an introductory podcast. So if you go back to my archives, there's 58 shows there while you were listening to this one. And they're of eclectic nature, but what I try to do is pick a topic that would have the broadest based appeal to those in agriculture. And what I mean by the broadest based appeal is that something that you could apply to all engines, vehicles, machinery, whatever you may have on the farm. But sometimes that is not the case. Sometimes a topic has to be application specific, or it has to be specific to a certain type of equipment or piece of machinery. So for instance, a few shows back, I did something on hydraulic motors. So obviously that's not really going to apply to your wife's SUV or your pickup truck. But today's show is going to apply basically to light-duty gasoline-powered vehicles. So let's call it cars, pickup trucks, what have you. You know, within the industry, because as those who are listening know, that I have one foot in agriculture and one foot in the automobile industry. And so within the industry, the automobile side of the equation, we call them all cars. It makes no difference whether it's a SUV, a pickup truck, a station wagon, a sports car, a Corvette, Mustang, what have you. We call them all cars. So this is going to be a car-related talk. And the reason why I feel that it is prudent for me to, at times, discuss some subjects that may only be related to cars is because we all have cars, we all have vehicles. And if your farm, it is just as important to keep it in my way of thinking. And you could argue this, or you could dispute it with me is probably a better term than argue, is that if the farm is a source or the source of your income, then any monies that are spent, be it on your personal vehicle or a combine, will be coming out of the profits earned on the farm. So it is just as important for you to have efficiencies in those other areas, in my mind, because you do not want to waste money fixing your pickup truck or your car that does that by having an avoidable repair. So that's why I feel that it is prudent for me at times to discuss things that are dedicated strictly to that. And when there happens to be an overlap into other areas, well, that's great and that's gravy. So just like hydraulic motors was basically dedicated to farm equipment, this is going to be dedicated to cars. And the subject that I am going to be covering on the show is I want to explain to you, my audience, my very valued audience, about oxygen sensors. So I think it's prudent for you to start to understand them. They've been around since, for the most part, since 1981. So that's quite a long time ago, right? Quite a long time ago. And they've actually have been integrated into other things. Some light-duty diesel pickup trucks, even though that will not be the focus of our discussion today, are using oxygen sensors. And in the past, you would never have a diesel engine with an oxygen sensor. There's no farm equipment or larger trucks or anything that I know of that are using an oxygen sensor, but light-duty diesels with using oxygen sensors with TFR emissions. And then some, believe it or not, some UTVs and larger UTVs and other applications are using an oxygen sensor. So that is what we will be talking about today. And my voice is giving out already, and I'm only 6 minutes into this show, which is not good, not good at all. I suffer from, recurring minor allergies. And so if you've noticed that the past couple of shows where my voice tends to be nasally, that's not my New Jersey accent. I guess part of it is, but I suffer from allergies. And August, when this show is being recorded, is I'm usually at my peak. And it's not an allergy where I sneeze or have runny eyes, but I get congested. And then when I talk like this to record a show, is that I try to enunciate and I try to project so there's good volume and clarity, and then I talk constantly for an hour, so I get kind of congested, and then I have to hit what they call the cough button on the recording equipment, and that allows me to pause the recording and then clear my throat and move on. So just so you could understand a little bit about your host and why lots of times my voice cracks, and it's just that it's my continual perpetual allergies, I guess. I don't take any medication for it or what have you, and it's really not as bad when I'm not talking. When I give a presentation, it comes up, but it's usually I'm able to get around it as I do with this show. So that is just a little explanation of FYI. So let's discuss what is an oxygen sensor. Let me divest for a minute, and let's talk about a thermostat that you have in the house for your heating and cooling system. So let's say it's winter time, and you have the thermostat set at 68 degrees. So what will basically happen, as you all know, but just bear with me because I'm using this as a precursor, as a build up into my discussion of oxygen sensors, is that the thermostat will be there, and then the house starts to get cold, and the temperature starts to drop, and at one particular, so let's say it drops down to 60, from 68 to 67 to 66, then at that particular point, the points in the thermostat close, and the heating system, the boiler or the furnace, or if it's electric heat, the heating system becomes evoked. The heat comes into the room, the temperature rises, and the thermostat recognizes that the temperature rises, and it shuts the heating system off. Alrighty, and then as long as the temperature is stable in the room, the heating system stays off, and then once the temperature starts to drop a certain amount, the heating system goes back on. So now, let's say that thermostat was skewed, and that thermostat was out of calibration, and you had it set at 68, but it really thinks that the room is 70. So if it thinks the room is 70 and you have it set at 68, then the temperature in the room may have to drop down to 62 or 63 before it thinks it's cold enough to evoke the heating system. Or in like fashion, but inversely, let's say it's the other way around, that the room undershoots the other way. So what I mean is that instead of it be thinking it's 70 degrees, it thinks it's 60 degrees, and it wants it to be at 68. So what's going to happen is going to evoke the heating system, and the heating system is going to run, and it's going to get it up to 72 or 73 degrees, and then it's going to think it's 68, and it's going to shut off. All right, so we've all experienced that with a failed thermostat. Now, why I'm giving you that example is because the thermostat, in essence, is an auditor. It's a watchdog. It's a control. It controls. It's basically a watchdog. I like to use the word when I teach it. It's a sentry. So what it is, it's a sentry over the temperature of the room, and it's going to tell the heating system to turn on and turn off to maintain that temperature in the room. Well, an oxygen sensor in the exhaust stream of a gasoline engine is exactly the same thing, though it's not looking at temperature as a thermostat would in the house, all right, but what it's looking at is the oxygen content in the exhaust. And it is using the oxygen content in the exhaust to determine the air-fuel ratio that is being fed to the engine. So it is the auditor, it is the sentry, it is the watchdog, all right? It is the quality control mechanism to identify what the air-fuel ratio is and then to give that output to a something. And why I'm saying a something is that whenever you have a sensor in any type of system, not just an engine controller, any type of system, that is called a closed loop system. So if you have a grain dryer, grain bins, right, and you have a system on there that monitors the humidity in the grain bins, the amount of moisture in the air, to turn the fans on and off, that is what is called a closed loop system, because it has a sensor, it has some sort of apparatus to analyze what the sensor is saying, and that apparatus, that whatever you want to call it, a computer, whatever, a control board, what have you, is able to analyze that, and then it makes a decision with the grain bin, right, to turn the fan on or to turn the fan off. On the thermostat in the house, it makes a decision to turn the heating system or the air conditioner on, or the heating system or the air conditioner off. On an oxygen sensor in an engine, it tells the controller, it is a closed loop system, so it tells the controller that the engine needs more fuel or less fuel. That's very, very simplistic, and we're going to pick it up from there. So a few key points that you need to understand about an oxygen sensor before we can move on. The oxygen sensor is always located in the exhaust stream, traditionally in the exhaust manifold, and as close to the exhaust port of the cylinder head as possible. So if you were to look, if you had to replace an oxygen sensor, we'll discuss that as the show goes on, and you're going to curse like heck because you say, all in this room, why that stupid engineer had to put it right up against the firewall or right over there. It's because they needed to have it as close to the exhaust port as possible for accuracy, because it needs the heat from the exhaust to help make it function. And I will explain that. All right. Now, what is So it's going to be very close to the exhaust port, which is often a very inconvenient place to service it, right? The other thing, it's going to have wires going to it. The early oxygen sensors that came out in the late 1970s in California, and basically for 1981 across the whole United States, had one wire. There's one wire, there's two wire, there's three wire, there's four wire, and there is five wires. And I will, oxygen sensors. And currently there's no more, there's none with more than five wires that I'm aware of. The one wire oxygen sensor is the most simplistic. You'll probably see that, you won't see that anymore unless you have an older vehicle that's still in service. Older pickup truck or what have you, older car that's still in service. All right, and what that did is that the sensor produces a voltage, a minute voltage, and the voltage output goes through that wire to the control unit, the ECU, ECM engine control unit, electronic control unit, whatever you want to call it. Those terms are all synonymous today. All right, and on a one wire oxygen sensor, it uses the connection threads as it threads into the exhaust manifold as its ground. So it's just like a spark plug. A spark plug's ground is where it threads into the cylinder head. All right, so that's why when you test for spark, you have to take the spark tester and ground it. So the one wire sensor has a ground through the threads of the exhaust manifold. A two-wire oxygen sensor has an external ground, so that has the signal output line, and it has an external ground that historically goes back to the control unit. A three-wire oxygen sensor, now this gets tricky, a three-wire oxygen sensor is a single wire oxygen sensor with a 12 volt heater element in it. So the one wire is 12 volts and the other wire is ground for the heater, and the oxygen sensor itself is grounded through its thread. So it's a one wire oxygen sensor with a 12 volt heater element in it. A four-wire oxygen sensor is a two-wire sensor. That means it has an external ground back to the ECU with a 12-volt heater in it. So the one ground wire is for the sensor output. The other ground wire is for the heater. The one wire is the signal output from the sensor, and the other wire is the 12-volt supply for the heater element. And then a five-wire oxygen sensor is a heated oxygen sensor. All right, so it has two of the five wires are for the heater, and then it is what is called a wideband oxygen sensor. And a wideband oxygen sensor has the ability to read a large range of air fuel ratios, and we will discuss that, and I will touch on that when it is appropriate in the show today. And the modern flex fuel vehicles that could run E85 or any combination of that fuel will use a wideband five wire oxygen sensor. Okay, the oxygen sensor itself, some basic get to know stuff before we talk about what you need to know as a farmer, is what is called a galvanic battery. And it actually takes a sample of the exhaust gas, and it also has a very small, unless you knew where it was, you're not going to see it, reference port to reference the amount of oxygen in the exhaust gas versus the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And for this galvanic battery to work, for it to create this minute voltage, which is between 0 and 1 volt. So that's what it's going to produce, between 0 and 1 volt. It's very, very low voltage. All right, it needs to have heat. So it needs to see the exhaust gas. It needs to sense or be exposed, probably is a better way of saying it, to the exhaust gas. And then it also needs to have heat. And what the heat does is makes the sensor, the galvanic battery, actually produce voltage. So it's a combination of having enough heat in it and to have the sense the exhaust gas for it to produce a voltage. All right, and that is why it is so close to the exhaust port of the cylinder head, because there is a there is an event called thermal inertia. I don't even think it's an event. I can't think of the proper word to use. All right. We'll say a theory. It's not even a theory, or it's just a fact of life, and that's called thermal inertia. And thermal inertia means that you have to heat up one area to a certain point before it's going to start to push the heat into another part of that same area. So, for instance, let's say anybody who uses a torch experiences and works with thermal inertia. All right, so let's say you want to heat up this bolt, right? The bolt is going to get hotter first because the torch is on it, and then what's going to happen, let's say you're going to heat up a bolt to cut it off, right? And so you're heating it up, and then what's going to happen is the heat is going to travel from that bolt into the area around it wherever that bolt is moored. Now, what has to happen, dependent upon the molecular structure and the compound of that bolt in that particular instance, it's not going to reject the heat right away. So as soon as you put the torch on, it's not going to send the heat a half inch away. All right, the bolt has to absorb a certain amount of heat and has to get a certain level of excitation of its molecules. And then once it gets to a certain point, it's going to start to reject some of that heat, because hot goes to cold, or it's going to reject some of that heat into the colder regions, and those regions are going to gain in temperature. And then even though you have the torch right on the bolt, it's going to increase in temperature, but at the same time it's going to be giving away some of the temperature. So as long as the heat coming from the torch is hotter than what it is giving away, the bolt itself in this particular instance will actually raise in temperature. So think of it this way. You have a leak in a tire. If you're putting the air in to the tire faster than it's leaking out, what will happen is that the tire will blow up with air. It's leaking out, but you're pumping it in faster than it is leaking. Well, when you're putting heat on a bolt or putting heat on something, all right, it's going to absorb the heat in at one particular point through what is called thermal inertia. The heat is actually going to have inertia momentum, and it's going to travel out of the heat affected zone. If you listen to my show back in months ago about stress relief of metal, it's called the heat affected zone, and it's going to, through thermal inertia, travel to there. So what basically happens is that the reason why the oxygen sensor needs to be as close to the exhaust port as possible is that that's where the heat is going, the exhaust is going to be the hottest, because as it travels down the pipe, it's going to be rejecting some heat through thermal inertia, and you want to have as much heat from that exhaust coming to that oxygen sensor so that battery, that galvanic battery, produces the most accurate voltage based upon the exhaust gas, the oxygen content in the exhaust gas. Now, that is why they came out with a three-wire oxygen sensor originally, which was a heated oxygen sensor, as I said. And by having the heat in the oxygen sensor, by having a artificial heat source, then it gave the industry more freedom to be able to package the oxygen sensor in a more serviceable location, not as close to the exhaust port as possible, all right? And I mean, it still can't be 15 feet away, but you could go another 6 inches or a foot away and what have you. It also gave the system more stability. And what I mean by stability, let's say that you're running this engine and you are idling for a long period of time. As you're idling, the exhaust is going to cool off, so that oxygen sensor through thermal inertia is going to cool off, and it's going to start to skew its output. And so by having the heater element in it, it is going to maintain its temperature for accuracy. All right, so you may have a UTV that has an oxygen sensor. Some motorcycles today have oxygen sensors. The pace then depending upon the emission package that engine has to, the emissions regulations, I should say, and thus the emission package that engine has to meet those regulations. Now, keep in mind that oxygen sensors were first seen in the United States on carburetor-equipped vehicles. So it is possible to have a carburetor and have an oxygen sensor also, but for the past 25 years, it would be all electronic fuel injection systems that are employing an oxygen sensor. Okay, so now, why did they need to put an oxygen sensor in the exhaust stream as this auditor? People thought that it controlled the air-fuel ratio. Or people not thought, they think it does. It really doesn't. In a roundabout way, it controls it by telling the ECU that it's too rich or too lean. But the actual calibration tables, and we're just going to talk about fuel injection here. We're not going to go back 35, almost 40 years to feedback carburetors, which is a carburetor with an oxygen sensor in the exhaust. All right, so inside the ECU, there's a lookup table. And this lookup table, or if it's a mathematic-based ECU, it does calculations based upon all the inputs and decides how long to keep the injector open to and how much fuel to deliver to the cylinder based upon the operating state of the engine. So now the oxygen sensor will tell the ECU whether it achieved the desired results. Just like the thermostat in the house will say, hey, the homeowner wants it 68, I hit 68, I shut off the heating system. Alrighty? So now, why was this so critical? Well, back in 1975, for the most part, every vehicle that was sold in the United States was equipped with a catalytic converter. And a catalyst, by definition, means that it speeds up a chemical reaction without itself becoming consumed, right? And the catalyst required the use of unleaded fuel, because the catalyst is made with precious metals, and these precious metals, usually rhodium and platinum, have a chemical reaction, and that chemical reaction, in simple terms, is what scrubs the exhaust and cleans up the CO, carbon monoxide, and hydrocarbons. If you look at a modern Tier 4 diesel, all right, they have an SCR system, selective catalytic reduction, and they also have a DOC, diesel oxidation catalyst. It works the same way, but has slightly different precious metals in it and a different design, because the exhaust output, the pollutants in a diesel engine, are different, have a different composition, slightly different composition than from a gasoline engine. So the catalytic converter came about. But an interesting thing, and I'm talking gas now, the interesting thing about a catalytic converter for a gasoline engine is that it is rated by its conversion efficiency. That's how efficient in it is taking that exhaust and scrubbing it. So basically, in essence, is that it is the yield of that catalytic converter. Or it's the population stand. So if you have your plant that's set at 20,000 seeds per acre, and you go out and do a check after the corn comes up, and you have 18,000 seeds per acre or 21,000 seeds per acre, then you know that planter meter is skewing slightly. All right. So the converter is rated upon its efficiency. And for the converter to be the most efficient, to have over 90% conversion rate, that means it's converting CO and HC into CO2, which is carbon dioxide, which is the gas in the bubbles in soda. So it's converting, meaning changing, CO and HC, carbon monoxide, partially burned fuel, hydrocarbons, unburned fuel, to carbon dioxide, which is soda gas, all right, non-polluting soda gas. So for it to convert at least 90% of those two pollutants into something that is benign, carbon dioxide, it needs to see an air-fuel ratio coming out of the engine of 14.7 to 1, which is what's called the stoichiometric mixture, and that happens to be this, and it's abbreviated stoic, that happens to be the stoichiometric mixture for unleaded fuel. Now, unleaded fuel, when it came out in 1975, was blended and created for a stoichiometric mixture of 14.7 to 1. And what stoichiometric means is that it is the greatest release of chemical energy. That's the mixture strength. So 14.7 parts of air to one part of fuel. Just like you could go in the field, and like I always say, I use Acuron. I'm putting 3 quarts per acre of Acuron in 20 gallons of water or 30 gallons of water, whatever you may have, all right? So the ratio, so unleaded gasoline was chemically formulated to have a stoichiometric value of 14.7 to 1 because for a catalytic converter to have its highest conversion rate, its highest, greatest efficiency, it needs to what they call engine out emissions. That means the emissions coming out of the engine into the catalyst needs to be at 14.7 to 1. If the mixture is leaner than 14.7 to 1 or richer than 14.7 to 1, the conversion efficiency drops down dramatically. So if you look at it, it's almost like an inverse bell curve. So as you go, what will happen is if you go leaner, it's going to drop down. As you go richer, it's going to drop down. And then the sweet spot is 14.7 to 1. So as the federal government tightened emission standards, it was recognized, because prior to around 1980 there was no oxygen sensor, and it was recognized that the catalytic converter many times was not running efficiently because the air fuel ratio being fed to it was richer or leaner than 14.7 to 1. And for those of us that are old enough and worked on engines back then, you would know that in the late 70s, all right, they used to have the plastic limiter caps on the carburetor mixture screws. And even if you buy something today, like I bought a new leaf blower, right? And that has like a 1979 car. It has a plastic limiter cap on the high speed and low speed mixture screws. So it only gives you a half a turn each way because they're not giving you full authority because they want to keep that, well, it's a two stroke, but we'll say they want to keep that mixture at a certain range, 14.7 to 1. So at first, back years ago, the cars had these plastic limiter caps, and then what we would do is we would take a pair of needle-nose pliers and bust the cap off, and then we would adjust the mixture, and people would adjust the mixture, but they didn't know how to adjust the mixture, because if you had it right, it would be fine, but they made them too rich, and then what would happen is the converter efficiency would ramp down, and the car would not meet, the engine would not meet emission standards. So by having the oxygen sensor in the system, all right, and by going to fuel injection, having no manual place for anybody to screw around with turning screws and make the adjustments, its whole purpose in life is to keep that air-fuel ratio at 14.7 to 1 under most driving conditions. Now, an engine requires a different air-fuel ratio for different operating states, and this makes no difference if it's your pickup truck or if it's a gasoline powered lawn tractor, irrigation pump, or what have you. At idle and light load, all right, it can run at 14.7 to 1. At full power, the mixture is going to need to be richer than 14.7 to 1 for the engine to produce the power that is required and for it not to burn a piston. So what happens is that the oxygen sensor sends an output voltage to the ECU, and this output voltage correlates to an air fuel ratio. So its output voltage is going to be between 0 and 1 volt. So the midpoint between 0 and 1 volt is a half a volt. And that is what is called the bias voltage, BIAS, the bias or the reference. So what will happen is that it wants to see that voltage average around a half a volt on its output, and that's telling the computer that we're at 14.7:1 under that driving scenario. And that is what is called when it's operating under closed loop. So the term closed loop, like I said, is used in many things. You may not identify it. You have a grain bin, you have a grain dryer, it's a closed loop system. Your wife has an oven in the house, right? There's a thermostat, and then she sets the oven for 350 degrees, and the oven cycles, duty cycles, right? I did a show a while back on pulse width modulated and duty cycle. So the oven cycles on and off. It gets below 350, it turns the heat on, whether it's electric or gas, and it gets to above 350, it shuts off and it maintains that average of 350 degrees. So whenever you have a sensor and that controls something, if I have a thermometer in the kitchen, if I have a weather station and I'm looking at the temperature inside and it says 72 degrees, that is not a closed loop system, because that thermometer is just telling me what the temperature is. It does not have the ability to modify the temperature in the room, which is identifying what it is. So we have many closed loop systems in our life, but we really don't identify it that way. So what the oxygen sensor does is says, hey, under these driving conditions, I want to keep this mixture at 14.7:1 because I want the catalytic converter to have its highest rate of efficiency, the highest conversion rate. Now, you're going to town in your pickup truck, right? And you're cruising down the road, 65 miles an hour, part throttle, light load. The catalytic converter, the engine wants 14.7:1. Now, you go to pass somebody, you whack it, right? You whack it to the floor, right? So now, what happens to make full power, that the engine now needs approximately a 12.5 to 13:1 air fuel ratio, much richer than stoichiometric, much richer than the catalytic converter wants. So now what will happen is that if the engine controller listened to the oxygen sensor all the time, then it would drive it back to 14. It would tell it to be 14.7:1, which would mean that you are not going to have the power to pass, and you're going to have elevated exhaust gas temperatures and have the ability to hurt the engine. So what the system does is, under those driving conditions, because it monitors the throttle angle, it monitors the engine speed, it monitors the load on the engine through either a mass airflow sensor or a manifold absolute pressure sensor, it looks at engine vacuum, it says, hey man, this guy whacked me to the floor, he wants full power. So even though the oxygen sensor is still producing a voltage, and the oxygen sensor is yelling, you're too rich, it closes its ears and ignores it, because the other sensors have indicated that we need full power and a richer mixture to 14.7:1. So what basically happens is, you're cruising down the highway, you're going to town, 14.7:1, the oxygen sensor is producing an output voltage that correlates to that. And then what will go, now you go to pass somebody, you whack it, it downshifts, man, this thing's feeling good, right? Tacking out and everything. The air fuel ratio goes to 12.9:1. The oxygen sensor's yelling, too rich, and it's saying, shut up, we're to the floor, we're passing this guy, all right? And then once you release the throttle, it sees the other inputs that is saying the throttle is now released, the engine speed is slowed down, the manifold vacuum has changed, and it goes back to listening to the oxygen sensor to be an auditor. But the mistake that people do not, the thing that people misunderstand is that it is an auditor, that the actual fuel calibration tables are not determined by the oxygen sensor. The oxygen sensor is telling the ECU whether it has seen the correct air fuel ratio. Now, what will happen, right? So that's in essence how it works. It produces an output voltage between 0 and 1 volt. Around 14.7 to 1 is a half a volt. Right, so if it averages that, it's at 14.7 to 1, and then it sends that data to the ECU, and the ECU takes that and recognizes that data and makes a correction to the air-fuel ratio, or ideally no correction. Because whatever, so the thing basically is that the common mistake is that people think that it always needs to be corrected. No, it does not. If the engine is tuned properly in good mechanical condition, and the calibration engineer wrote the calibration accurately, then the oxygen sensor will have no effect whatsoever because the air-fuel ratio is perfect. Right? So what the oxygen sensor is there for is to make up in inefficiencies of the engine as the injectors get dirty, as the air filter gets dirty, as the pistons build carbon on them, as one of the vacuum hoses starts to leak a little bit, all right, as the piston ring seal starts to go away. So when that vehicle is brand new, that engine is brand new, there should be zero correction by the oxygen sensor, and it should be all green lights all the way. But now, as the engine gets some mileage on it, and those things, as I mentioned, start to occur, then it may start to skew. Because let's say if you get a dirty injector, we did a show about this, all right, about a month or so ago, you get a dirty injector, you are not atomizing that fuel properly. If you are not atomizing that fuel properly, then that fuel is not going to burn correctly, and it's going to have a different air-fuel ratio. So the oxygen sensor will see this and say, hey, we're too rich or we're too lean, and it'll tell the ECU to tweak the calibration, the amount of fuel delivered through the injector minutely to go and achieve the desired results. But this is happening because you do have dirty injectors and you didn't put an injector cleaner in, or you have a lot of deposits on the backside of the intake valve. And, you know, I've discussed this in my Tier 4 program, is that, you know, and this is not about oxygen sensors, but Tier 4 basically looks at everything, and if you want to have a minimum amount of regeneration cycles of the diesel particulate filter, all right, and you want to use the minimum amount of diesel exhaust fluid in the SCR, you need to have a clean and efficient combustion event, and that happens by running high quality fuel with an injector cleaner, a cetane boost, and a fuel stabilizer. If you have properly additized fuel and that engine is running very cleanly, that you're going to have a minimum of regen cycles, and you're going to use a minimum amount of diesel exhaust fluid for oxides of nitrogen reduction. So the same thing basically happens to a lesser extent with the oxygen sensor. The whole idea is for it to keep giving the ECU thumbs up, baby, thumbs up, perfect air fuel ratio. But as the engine does get older and start to skew, that the oxygen sensor is there as an auditor. So people think that if you have no oxygen sensor, the thing is going to run poorly or run dump fuel. It's not. It's basically going to go and it's going to tell it, like the thermostat in the room, is it doing the right job, is it the right results, or is it not the right results. All right, so now a couple, as we start to come three quarters of the way through here today's show, a couple of things about oxygen sensors. Number one is that when you buy, if the oxygen sensor, let me back up first. The oxygen sensor, for most part, an industry standard that it has about 20 to 25% control. So what this means is that the oxygen sensor could start to skew. It could start to go bad. It could go out of calibration because it's sitting in the exhaust for 100,000 miles, 200,000 miles, all right, could start to skew. But the oxygen sensor has the ability to command approximately 20% more fuel to the engine or 20% less. So if the engine is running and you create a small vacuum leak, then the oxygen sensor will sense that the engine is running lean, and it may add 3 or 4%, 2% fuel to get the air-fuel ratio back to 14.7:1. If you pull off the hose to the power brake booster, you got this massive 5/8-inch hole in the vacuum leak, all right? It's only going to be able to add about 20% fuel. Then it's not going to be able to bring it back to 14.7. So the thing is that every system has at least three codes for the oxygen sensor, diagnostic codes, and that's the system is too lean, the system is too rich, the system is not responding. All right, so what happens is here is that the when it says too rich or too lean, it actually means out of control rich or out of control lean, meaning that the amount of fuel that is either required to be added or subtracted, all right, out of control lean means it needs to add fuel, went beyond the 20% or 25%, depending upon that calibration, and it's still not could achieve the results of 14.7:1. So that's why it says it's out of control. All right, and then if it doesn't see the output voltage bouncing up and down and averaging, then it says that the system is inactive. Okay, so those are the codes. So now the thing basically is that you could have an oxygen sensor that's starting to go bad. It's starting to go bad, and historically when they fail on the lean side. So they keep adding fuel to think that it's that, so they think that it's too lean even though the engine is rich. So it keeps adding fuel. If you're at 18% addition of fuel that you're correcting by 18%, that system is not going to set a trouble code. But what you're going to do is you're going to be running that engine very rich. You're going to be washing the oil off the cylinder walls because a port injector spraying right in the cylinder, oil off the cylinder walls, and you're going to be polluting the oil, and you're going to be hurting that catalytic converter, because the catalytic converter, when the mixture is too rich, that is when you smell that sulfur smell. Somebody passes you on the highway, they whack the throttle, you get a little bit of a stink from the car in front of you. That's from the catalytic converter being overfueled. All right, so as the rule of thumb is that as an oxygen sensor starts to wear, meaning it becomes coated, and it's the galvanic battery becomes just like a battery in a car. I'm going to say it's sulfate. It's not truly sulfate like a battery in a car, but it becomes weak, and it requires a richer mixture to produce the same output voltage, so it ends up driving the engine richer. All right, and that is going to hurt the engine and eventually hurt the catalytic converter. All right, conversely, if you have a leaky injector, you have an injector that's not shutting off, or you have a fuel pressure regulator that's stuck and the fuel pressure is too high, the mixture is going to be richer. If it's within 20% being rich and the oxygen sensor can control the air fuel ratio by cutting back the pulse width, all right, just like we spoke about the pulse width modulated show, like on a spray, the pulse width of the injector is going to be cut back 20%, or at 18%, that's within range of control of the oxygen sensor, it is not going to set a trouble code. All right, so now through what is called a scan tool that plugs into the OBD2 connector, you could read the amount of correction and the output voltage on the sensor. Without that, you're flying blind, buddy. I mean, you're flying blind. You know, no instruments, no anything. You're just looking for the horizon, looking for the landing strip. All right, so keep that in mind. This is not something where you could say that you're going to be able to read this. If you invested in an inexpensive scan tool, you could, but you're not going to be able to read this with a voltmeter or what have you. All right, so the thing is that, so what we need to understand is the oxygen sensor is a galvanic battery. It needs heat. All right, it produces a voltage. All right, The threads of the oxygen sensor have anti-seize compound on them from the factory. If you look, it's going to be a gray, very dry anti-seize compound. It's not going to be like an anti-seize compound that you would buy in a can with an acid brush and put on like you would put on a spark plug. It's a dry film anti-seize compound, right? And it's on there so the oxygen sensor does not rust into the exhaust manifold. So if it needs to be replaced, is that you don't have to take the exhaust manifold off the car because you seized it. It's seized in there, all right? So it's going to have anti-seize compound on it. You don't need to put anything more. And it's going to have a washer, which looks a tapered washer, which looks akin to a spark plug washer. Most have a washer. They all have anti-seize compound. When you remove the old oxygen sensor, all right, and you put the new one in, you just want it snug. You want to seat it and just not even make it snug, just so it doesn't leak air, have an exhaust leak to suck in oxygen, all right? You just want it snug. You don't want to moose this thing in there, because if you moose it and it goes bad, you're buying an exhaust manifold. You're taking the exhaust manifold off the engine. So this is not put in with an impact gun. It's not put in like King Kong. You're going to seat it, and that's basically it's just snug, if even that. You want to seat it in maybe a 16th of a turn, even if that, after that, you just want to seat it till it stops, and that's good enough. You don't want to make it tight, because then you are going to have a problem if it needs to be replaced. So now that we have a little understanding of how the oxygen sensor works, let's give you some practical applications so you could apply value for you spending a time listening to me today. All right. Now, oxygen sensors will wear out. They won't wear out like you would see like a tire worn out, but they will skew over time. And what basically will happen is that the length of the life cycle of the oxygen sensor is going to be greatly determined on the use of the vehicle, use of the engine. So if you do a lot of short trips, you will do a lot of cold starts and a lot of idling, all right, then that oxygen sensor is going to not last as long as a guy who's running down the road 300 miles a day at highway speeds. You could have, like, for instance, my little Ford Escort at 450,000 miles, that 260,000, I renewed the oxygen sensor, was 100% fine, its output was fine, I checked it with a scan tool, its correction was fine, all right, the thing basically is that, but I figured, hey, 250,000, I'll change it because who knows if it's going to start to skew, right? Fine. My father, when he was alive, he had a little Ford Focus. He used to go 5 or 6 miles to town to the supermarket, 5 or 6 miles back, 3 or 4 miles to town hall or whatever like that, to go get a haircut. At 12,000 miles, his oxygen sensor was shot. All right? It already was so far out of control that it put the check engine light on and set a code. All right, so if you have a engine that's doing a lot of idling, if you're doing a lot of idling, you're doing a lot of short trips, a lot of cold starts, then that oxygen sensor life is not going to be as long. It's going to have a shortened life. If the engine is burning oil, has bad valve stem seals, all right, it burns oil and start off, rings are starting to go bad, all right, PCV, positive crankcase ventilation system, is not working properly, all right, then that oxygen sensor is going to have a decreased life, because what happens in both the cold starts and the short trips and putting oil through the engine is that you actually coat the sensing element, all right, underneath that shell is where the exhaust gas, there's little vents in there, exhaust gas is exposed to zirconia, is one of the metals, and it actually coats the zirconia and insulates it from the exhaust. So it's like putting a insulator around the thermostat. It doesn't really know what the room temperature is because you're insulating it. So that's what happens to the sensor, is they become coated. If the engine had a head gasket failure and it put coolant, antifreeze, no matter what type of antifreeze, all right, through the combustion chamber, then that is going to create silica. And silica is going to coat the oxygen sensor, and it is going to render it ineffective because it's going to skew it. And as I said, with almost no exception, all right, no exception, an oxygen sensor that is coated will now start to add fuel, think of it as a thermostat. It's going to think the room is colder than it is, and it's going to keep running the furnace. All right, so it's going to keep the injector open, thinking that it's leaner than it is, because it always, with rare exception, does it skew the other way. You could have a failure in the oxygen sensor. There is a gasket, there is a seal that from the external atmospheric sensing point to, as a comparator to the exhaust gas, if that gasket goes bad inside, then it's possible for it to fail the other way and lean the mixture out instead of richening it. But most oxygen sensors, in my whole career, I think I've seen one fail that way. The others are all skewed and degraded. The term is degraded from short trips, idling, all right, idling, and a poor state of operation in the engine, that it's burning oil, antifreeze, head gasket job, what have you. So now, one of the signs on an engine with a closed loop system will be that if it has a catalytic converter, that you may start to notice that the smell, that the converter starts to smell, and that means that it's running too rich. All right, but that's by the time you smell out, it's pretty bad. All right. But if you monitor your fuel economy, then you'll start to see a degradation of fuel economy. But the thing is that if you have a vehicle that is a short trip vehicle, doesn't really get used much, and there's no way that you could clean off the oxygen sensor. Once it becomes coated, it's coated. Forget about it. Then what you would probably want to do is every 5 or 6 years, 4 or 5 years, all right, you may want to put the oxygen sensor in. And what I'm talking about is the primary oxygen sensor. And if it's a V-shaped engine, we'll have 2, 1 for each bank. And then there's a secondary oxygen sensor, which is after the catalytic converter. That one hardly ever goes bad. That's just there to monitor the catalytic converter. All right. If you have an ATV, a UTV, and you do a lot of short start stops with it, every couple of years you want to change the oxygen sensor. Many engines are worn out prematurely because of a failed oxygen sensor. Not a failed oxygen sensor, I'm using the wrong word, I have to correct myself. A skewed oxygen sensor, because what it does is it runs the engine richer, and it's washing the oil off the cylinder walls, and then the rings wear, and there's oil in the, there's gasoline in the oil, the bearings wear, and what have you. So it's very important to monitor that. Consider the oxygen sensor a consumer. Consider the oxygen sensor consumable, and then depending upon the use of the vehicle, if it's basically used more on the highway, you're putting 15,000-20,000 miles a year, you're not idling a lot, all right, you're not idling a lot, then you could say, I'm going to change it every 100,000 miles or so. If it's a shorter trip car, you may want to change it every 30 or 40, 50,000 miles. It all depends upon the use. The way that you could tell, this is not a guessing game, the way that you could tell is by through a scan tool, and you need to look at the amount of correction that is being issued. All right, the amount of correction that is being issued, if the engine doesn't have a vacuum leak or any other problem, and you'll take that for granted that it doesn't, if you see that it's constantly adding fuel at one particular point, then that's a pretty good indicator of the oxygen sensor starting to skew. Now, on a flex fuel vehicle, it uses that oxygen sensor as one of the components. It's a 5-wire oxygen sensor. It's able to read a wide range of air fuel ratios, not just 14.7 to 1, and that oxygen, it's actually called a virtual flex fuel system. And by looking at the oxygen content in the exhaust, that allows it to see that it has more ethanol in the fuel, and it opens the injector, adds pulse width to the injector so that it can compensate for the lower energy content of the ethanol. Early flex fuel vehicles also had what's called a flex fuel sensor in the fuel rail, which would measure the amount of ethanol in the gasoline. And the more modern ones did away with the flex fuel sensor, and they do it all through the oxygen sensor. So keep that in mind. If you have a flex fuel vehicle, all right, and you do a lot of short trips with that or what have you, that oxygen sensor starts to skew, it's going to mess up that whole E85 calculations. All right, so that's something to keep in mind. So in as we close today with this, in practical, you have a practical understanding of the oxygen sensor. It is a consumable, all right? It can be checked with a scanner. You could get telltale signs by the fuel economy that the engine is getting. And if you did invest in a scan tool, you could look at the amount of correction that is being issued as part of that data stream. If you do a lot of idling, a lot of short trips, figure it wouldn't be a bad idea every 30, 40,000 miles to change an oxygen sensor. If you do more highway driving at higher speeds, you go 100, 200, 300,000 miles. If you have a head gasket failure, you're going to pollute that oxygen sensor. You're going to coat it with silica, and it's going to need to be replaced. Any questions on this, please, please contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And I said, as in the beginning of the show, this is important because you washed the rings out of a motor today. That's big money. You're putting a motor in that car. All right. And I don't want you putting a motor in a $40,000 SUV prematurely because of a polluted oxygen sensor, degraded oxygen sensor, because you used this vehicle to idle a lot and did a lot of short trips checking center pivots, checking cattle, just going a couple miles to town. So to me, that's just as important as a hydraulic motor in a combine, all right, because that's coming out of the farm profits. And I don't want you spending money on unnecessary repairs. I want your vehicles to last, your engines to last, your equipment to last. And I want you to put that money in a bank, or I want you to put that money someplace where it's going to make your farm more profitable in fertility and better genetics and better genetics for your herd, what have you. Any place other than a ring job, a piston ring job, because of a $30, $40 oxygen sensor, you didn't understand it. So, case closed. Alrighty? Now we're going to go to special delivery, and special delivery is brought to us by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is still the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar, AD2 technology, the new Evo tire, and the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. We all learned that this year, right? I mean, especially with that damp spring that caused compaction. You have a IF or VF tire, you have a much better chance of going in that field without doing permanent damage. So the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Alrighty, I have a quick question here. George from Texas writes, I had a clutch put in my older Chevy pickup truck that I use around the farm, and now I have problems with it releasing and sticking and not working properly. The flywheel was not turned, but an aftermarket clutch was used. What do you think I should do? Well, at this particular point, George, thank you for listening to the show and for writing me. Basically, in essence, I could do a whole show on this, and I probably will, about what needs to be done properly when you service a clutch on anything. I don't know. There's a very good, you see, the flywheel and the pressure plate and disc need to be parallel. Once the clutch is shot, you know that flywheel is warped. And without machining that flywheel, making that surface true, that clutch pressure plate and that disc is no longer going to be parallel. And if it's no longer going to be parallel, then there's a very good possibility that that clutch is not going to work properly. How is it going to present itself? Well, it may stick, it may grab, it may bind, it may slip. It could present itself in a number of different ways because that surface isn't parallel. The other thing that comes into play is that the flywheel itself may be glazed and have some hot spots on it, and another component of this is the mechanic who did the job. Did he lubricate where the throwout bearing is going to go to push against the forks or what have you? So the thing basically is the job is not good. It needs to be redone. You're either going to live with the truck the way it is, or you're going to have to pull the trans back out, take the clutch apart, and look at it. All right, I'm sure it's fine at this particular point. You have to take that flywheel, bring it into town, get it machined so it's parallel. You're going to have to make sure that the throwout bearing is all lubricated and put it back together. It'll be fine. To tell you the truth, I think you probably just have a stack up of different things, and probably the majority of your problem is with a non-parallel surface between the clutch disc and the pressure plate and the flywheel, and that's why it is responding the way it is. So sorry, I wish I could tell you something else, but in an older Chevy pickup truck, it's really not that bad to pull the trans out, especially if it's a two-wheel drive, and take that flywheel off and have it done properly. And I don't know what year it is, but if it is 1986 or newer, it probably has a one-piece rear main seal, and when you have that flywheel off, just pop a new rear main seal in there. If it's a two-piece rear main seal and it's not leaking, I would leave it, but a one-piece is so easy to pop in there once the flywheel and trans is out. If you have any questions, please, I'm sorry I blew through your question, but that's really the there's no long story to it. It needs to be done correctly. Listen, thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a better understanding of oxygen sensors and how a degraded oxygen sensor can cost your farm a lot of money. Hey, you wash the rings out, you're talking $5,000-$7,000 on a motor. I want you to put that into fertility. I want you to put that in the bank. I don't want you to put it in a ring job. So listen, thank you again for listening. You have a blessed week, and know that I, the Hot Rod Farmer, is pulling for you, the American farmer rancher, and my beloved America. America rocks, baby. Talk to you next week.